A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one about criminology. He met an undergraduate studying it, and it got him thinking about what criminologists actually do, where they work, and what would surprise people who assume it's just the study of crime. His instinct was that criminology students want to become detectives or work in law enforcement, maybe intelligence. But then the question becomes, if that's the goal, why the academic track instead of working your way up through a force? There's a genuine tension there worth unpacking.
The tension is the right place to start, because it points to what most people get wrong about the field. Criminology is not police training. It's not forensic science. It's a social science. It sits in the same family as sociology, psychology, economics, and political science. The central question isn't who did it or how do we catch them. It's why does crime happen, what does society do about it, and does any of that actually work?
When someone says, I'm studying criminology, they're not necessarily signing up to interrogate suspects. They're signing up to interrogate the entire system that produces suspects in the first place.
And that's the first surprise right there. The Bureau of Labor Statistics groups criminologists under the sociologist umbrella. The American Society of Criminology, the main professional body, was founded in 1941, and its membership includes sociologists, psychologists, legal scholars, economists, and public health researchers. It's an interdisciplinary field by design.
Which means the undergraduate Daniel met could end up in a dozen different careers that have nothing to do with a badge and a gun.
Let's walk through the actual landscape. Criminologists work in six broad domains. First, academia. Universities hire them to teach and do research. Second, government research agencies. The National Institute of Justice, the Bureau of Justice Statistics, state-level criminal justice planning agencies. Third, think tanks and policy institutes, places like the Vera Institute of Justice or the Urban Institute. Fourth, law enforcement agencies themselves, but in analytic and strategic roles, not patrol. Fifth, corrections and rehabilitation, designing programs, evaluating what reduces recidivism. And sixth, the private sector, insurance companies, cybersecurity firms, loss prevention for retailers.
That's already more varied than most people would guess. But let's dig into what they actually produce. I think the public image of a criminologist is someone standing over a body with a clipboard. What's the real day-to-day output?
The National Institute of Justice breaks criminology into several core research areas. You've got the causes and correlates of crime. That's the classic. Why question, looking at risk factors, developmental pathways, neighborhood effects. Then there's crime measurement and patterns. How much crime is actually happening, which is a lot harder to answer than it sounds, because official statistics miss huge amounts of unreported crime. Then you've got victimology, studying who gets victimized, why, and what the consequences are beyond the immediate incident. Then there's the study of the criminal justice system itself, police, courts, corrections, and whether they're effective. And finally, there's prevention and intervention research. What programs actually reduce crime, and which ones just sound good?
A criminologist might spend their career studying why shoplifting rates go up in certain economic conditions, and never once arrest a shoplifter.
And here's a concrete example that grounds this. The National Crime Victimization Survey, the NCVS, is one of the most important criminological data sets in the United States. It's been running since 1973, and it surveys about 240,000 people per year across roughly 150,000 households. It asks them about their experiences with crime, regardless of whether they reported it to police. That survey is designed, administered, and analyzed by criminologists and statisticians, not by detectives.
240,000 people a year. That's the kind of scale most people don't associate with crime research. They picture a crime scene, not a survey instrument.
The NCVS reveals something fundamental that shapes the whole field. The gap between crimes reported to police and crimes that actually occur is enormous. For example, only about 40% of violent crimes and about 30% of property crimes are reported to law enforcement. That's not a failure of policing. It's a reality about human behavior. People don't report for all kinds of reasons. They don't trust the system. They're afraid of retaliation. They don't think the crime was serious enough. They handled it informally.
Which means that any policy built solely on police data is built on a minority of what's actually happening. The criminologist's job in BART is to see the whole picture and tell policymakers what they're missing.
This is where the academic track makes complete sense. You can't design a national victimization survey by working your way up through a police department. You need training in sampling methodology, survey design, statistical analysis, and the ethical frameworks for research with human subjects. That's a PhD-level skill set.
Let's talk about the detective assumption directly. Daniel's instinct was that criminology students want to become detectives. Some of them probably do. But what does the actual career path into detective work look like? And does a criminology degree help?
In most police departments in the United States, you cannot be hired as a detective. You're hired as a patrol officer, you work the street for several years, and then you test or apply into a detective bureau. The degree helps. Departments often prefer candidates with relevant degrees for promotion, but it's not a fast track that skips the patrol years. In the UK, there's a direct entry detective scheme that's relatively new, but it's controversial within policing circles. The argument against it is that you can't investigate crimes effectively if you don't understand the street.
Which makes intuitive sense. You'd want a detective who knows what a patrol officer's night looks like.
So if someone's passion is specifically detective work, the most direct route is still joining a force and working up. The criminology degree is valuable background, but is not the main pipeline. What the degree really prepares you for is the analytic and policy side, the jobs where you're asking whether the detective bureau is structured effectively or whether the investigative techniques being used have any empirical basis for success.
That brings us to something that might surprise people. Criminologists don't just study criminals. They study the system that responds to criminals, and sometimes what they find is deeply uncomfortable for that system.
Let me give you a concrete case. The RAND Corporation did a famous study in the 1970s called the Criminal Investigation Process Study. They looked at how detectives actually solve crimes, and they found something counterintuitive. The vast majority of cases that get solved are solved because a patrol officer identifies a suspect at the scene, or a witness provides a name in the first few hours. The detective's follow-up investigation, the interviews, the lab work, the shoe leather stuff, contributed to the solution in only a small fraction of cases. Most detective work was essentially administrative, documenting what was already known for the prosecution file.
That's a grenade in the middle of every police procedural ever made. The entire genre assumes the detective's brilliance cracks the case. Rand says the patrol officer and the witness cracked it in the first hour.
That study reshaped how departments thought about detective allocation. It didn't eliminate detectives, it clarified what they're actually useful for. But it's exactly the kind of finding that comes from criminological research, not from within policing culture itself. A career detective might suspect that pattern from experience, but they're not running the controlled study.
The criminologist is the person who tells the detective, here's what your job actually does, statistically speaking. I can see why that relationship might be tense.
It often is. There's a long-running friction between academic criminology and law enforcement practitioners. Practitioners say the academics don't understand the realities of the street. Academics say practitioners are operating on instinct and tradition rather than evidence. The truth is that both perspectives are necessary, but the tension is real.
Let's talk about where criminologists actually work, because I think that's where a lot of the surprise is. Most people imagine a criminologist in a police station or a university. What's the less obvious employer?
Insurance is a huge one. Insurance companies employ criminologists and crime analysts to model risk. Where are thefts likely to happen? What kinds of properties get targeted? What security measures actually reduce claims? The actuarial side of crime is criminological work, even if nobody calls it that.
The person who decided your car insurance premium in a high-theft neighborhood might have a criminology background.
Or at least uses models built by people who do. Cybersecurity is another growing area. The study of cybercrime, who commits it, what motivates them, what interventions work, that's criminology applied to digital space. The FBI's cyber division employs criminologists. So do private cybersecurity firms.
Retail loss prevention. You mentioned that earlier.
Large retailers have entire teams dedicated to understanding theft patterns, employee theft versus external theft, the effectiveness of different deterrent strategies. That's applied criminology, often with a business school wrapper rather than a sociology department wrapper, but the core questions are the same.
What about corrections? I imagine criminologists are deeply involved in prisons.
And this is where the field gets into some of its most contested territory. The question of what reduces recidivism, that's the rate at which released prisoners reoffend, is one of the central debates in criminology. For decades, the dominant assumption was that nothing worked. That was the famous conclusion of a 1974 paper by Robert Martinson, who reviewed 231 studies of rehabilitation programs and concluded that with few exceptions, nothing had a measurable effect on recidivism.
That's a grim slogan for a field.
It became the slogan of an era, and it contributed to the massive expansion of incarceration in the United States, the logic being, if rehabilitation doesn't work, the only thing to do is lock people up longer. But here's where criminology corrected itself. In the 1990s and 2000s, researchers developed more sophisticated meta-analytic techniques and found that Martinson was wrong, or at least his conclusion was too sweeping. Some programs do work. Cognitive behavioral therapy, drug treatment, education, vocational training, these can reduce recidivism by 10 to 30% when done well.
The field had a nothing works phase, built an entire incarceration policy on it, and then discovered it was wrong. That's not just an academic correction. That's a historical course correction with millions of lives affected.
The correction is still being absorbed. The United States has the highest incarceration rate in the world, roughly 639 per 100,000 as of the most recent data, compared to about 145 in the UK, about 100 in Germany. The nothing works era helped build that. The some things work era is slowly unwinding it, but institutions have enormous inertia.
A criminology student today is entering a field that's still dealing with the consequences of its own past conclusions. That's heavy.
But it's also what makes it intellectually compelling. You're not just studying crime statistics. You're studying how societies respond to transgression. And those responses reveal what a society actually values versus what it claims to value.
Let's pull on that thread. What does the criminological evidence say about deterrence? The public assumption is that harsher punishments deter crime. Is that what the research shows?
This is one of the most robust findings in criminology, and it's deeply counterintuitive to most people. The certainty of punishment deters crime far more than the severity of punishment. In other words, if people think they're likely to get caught, they're less likely to offend. But making the punishment longer or harsher has very little marginal deterrent effect.
The death penalty doesn't deter murder more than life imprisonment.
The consensus of the research is no. The National Research Council concluded in 2012 that studies claiming a deterrent effect for the death penalty were fundamentally flawed and that the evidence does not support the claim. The reason is straightforward. Most violent crimes are committed in states of intense emotion, under the influence of substances, or in circumstances where the perpetrator is not calmly weighing the penalty schedule.
Which means the entire tough-on-crime political framework, at least as it relates to sentence length, is built on an assumption that doesn't hold up empirically.
This is where criminology gets political, whether it wants to or not. The field produces findings that challenge both left-wing and right-wing orthodoxies. The left doesn't like findings that show some policing strategies actually reduce crime. The right doesn't like findings that show longer sentences don't deter. A criminologist who's doing honest work is going to irritate everybody eventually.
The equal opportunity irritant. I like that.
It's an honest position. Daniel's question about why someone would take the academic track rather than just working up through a force, I think the answer is becoming clear. The academic track is where you learn to ask questions that a police force, by its nature, is not structured to ask. A police department's job is to enforce the law. A criminology department's job is to study whether the enforcement of the law is achieving its intended effects, and at what cost, and for whom.
Those are fundamentally different missions. One is operational, one is evaluative. They need each other, but they're not the same thing.
Let me give you another concrete domain where criminologists work that might surprise people. This is the study of how physical space shapes crime, Not in a broken windows theory sense exactly, but in a much more specific, design-oriented sense. Where do crimes cluster geographically? Why do certain street layouts produce more burglaries? How does lighting actually affect assault rates? Not what we assume, but what the data show.
A criminologist might end up advising city planners and architects.
The field of crime prevention through environmental design, CPTED, pronounced SEPTED, is a whole sub-discipline. It emerged from the work of C.I. Ray Jeffrey in the 1970s and was developed further by the architect Oscar Newman in his book, Defensible Space. The idea is that the built environment can be designed to reduce crime opportunities. Things like natural surveillance. Can residents see the street from their windows? Territorial reinforcement. Do the physical cues make it clear that a space is owned and cared for? Access control. Can you limit who enters a space without making it feel like a fortress?
The Oscar Newman connection is interesting. An architect and a criminologist collaborating. That's not the image most people have of the field. They picture cops and robbers, not blueprints and sightlines.
Newman's work came out of a specific observation. He looked at public housing projects in New York City and noticed that the high-rise towers had much higher crime rates than the low-rise buildings, even when the resident populations were demographically similar. His argument was that the design of the towers, long anonymous corridors, elevators that were effectively unmonitored spaces, no clear demarcation between public and private territory, created environments where crime was easier and residents felt less ownership and responsibility.
The building itself was a criminogenic factor.
And that's a word criminologists use, criminogenic. It means crime-producing. The insight is that crime isn't just about individual bad actors. It's about situations, opportunities, environments, systems. A criminologist looks at a dark alley and doesn't just see a place where a mugging might happen. They see a design failure that created an unnecessary opportunity.
Which connects to something else I want to ask about. If criminology is this broad, where do criminal profilers fit in? The FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit. That's what pop culture thinks criminology is. Is it actually part of the academic discipline?
It's a small, specialized, and somewhat controversial part. Criminal profiling, or criminal investigative analysis, as the FBI calls it, is the attempt to infer offender characteristics from crime scene behavior. It's practiced by a relatively small number of people, mostly within law enforcement agencies. The academic criminology community has been skeptical of profiling for decades because the empirical evidence for its accuracy is thin. There have been very few controlled studies testing whether profilers actually do better than chance.
The most famous version of criminology in popular culture is the one that actual criminologists are most skeptical of.
Shows like Criminal Minds and Mindhunter have given the public the impression that criminology is primarily about getting inside the mind of a serial killer. In reality, serial homicide accounts for a tiny fraction of all crime. Maybe 1% of homicides at most. And the profiling approach is just one niche methodology that many criminologists regard as more art than science.
The David Fincher version of criminology versus the Bureau of Justice Statistics version.
A lovely way to put it. And the Bureau of Justice Statistics version employs far more people and produces far more actionable knowledge. But it doesn't make for good television.
If we're advising Daniel's undergraduate acquaintance, or anyone considering the field, what's the honest picture of career prospects?
The Bureau of Labor Statistics projects about 5% growth for sociologists, which includes criminologists, over the next decade. That's roughly average. The median pay is around $98,000 per year. But that number masks huge variation. A criminologist at a research university with a PhD can earn substantially more. A crime analyst at a mid-sized police department with a master's degree might earn significantly less. The private sector, insurance, cybersecurity, consulting, tends to pay better than government or academia.
The degree level matters a lot.
A bachelor's in criminology is a generalist social science degree. It qualifies you for entry-level positions in probation, parole, victim advocacy, crime analysis, or as a stepping stone to law school or graduate school. But the jobs where you're actually designing research, running evaluations, and shaping policy almost always require a master's or a PhD.
The undergraduate Daniel met is at the beginning of a path that could fork in a dozen directions, but most of the interesting folks require more school.
Which brings us back to the original question. why the academic track instead of working up through a force? Because the academic track is the only way to reach most of the careers we've described. You can't become a sentencing policy researcher at the Vera Institute by starting as a patrol officer. You can't become a crime data scientist at a major insurance firm by working your way up through a detective bureau. The skills are different, the networks are different, the credentialing is different.
It's almost two separate professions that happen to share a subject matter, the practitioner and the analyst.
There's a third category too, the academic who studies the practitioners and the analysts, the sociology of criminology, if you will. Who gets to define what counts as crime? Whose knowledge is considered authoritative? These are level questions that criminologists also study.
Let's talk about something that I think genuinely surprises people about the field, the international dimension. Is criminology the same everywhere, or does it vary by country?
It varies enormously. American criminology has historically been very focused on street crime, violent crime, and incarceration, for obvious reasons given the U.S. crime and punishment landscape. British criminology has a stronger tradition of critical and cultural criminology, influenced by the Birmingham School of Cultural Studies. Continental European criminology often integrates more closely with legal scholarship and has been more skeptical of purely quantitative approaches. The Scandinavian countries have developed a whole tradition of studying crime through the lens of social welfare and inequality.
A criminology student in Norway is having a very different intellectual experience than one in Texas.
And the policy implications are different too. Norway's incarceration rate is about 75 per 100,000, roughly 1/8 of the U.S. rate. Their prisons look different, their sentencing philosophy is different, their recidivism rates are different. A Norwegian criminologist is studying a fundamentally different system than an American one.
Which raises the question, does criminology travel? Can you take a finding from one country and apply it to another?
That's one of the central methodological challenges in the field. Crime is deeply embedded in culture, law, economics, and history. A policing strategy that works in a homogeneous, high-trust society might fail completely in a heterogeneous, low-trust one. A sentencing reform that reduces recidivism in Germany might have no effect in Brazil. The field has gotten much more sophisticated about acknowledging context and not overclaiming generalizability.
The criminologist's humility is that they can tell you what worked in a specific time and place, but they can't necessarily tell you it'll work in yours.
That's a hard thing to say to a policymaker who wants a clear, actionable answer. It depends. Is the honest answer to most criminological questions, and it's also the answer nobody wants to hear.
Let's shift to something that might be the most surprising context of all. White-collar crime. How much of criminology is devoted to the crimes of the powerful versus the crimes of the poor?
Not enough, according to many criminologists. The study of white-collar and corporate crime is a recognized subfield, but it's vastly under-resourced compared to the study of street crime. The term white-collar crime was coined by Edwin Sutherland in 1939, and he was making exactly this argument, that criminology was obsessed with the crimes of the poor and ignored the crimes of the powerful, which were often far more damaging in financial and social terms.
Sutherland was the one who said that corporate executives were criminals too, just with better lawyers.
And he faced enormous resistance. The idea that a respectable businessman could be studied as a criminal was considered radical. Sutherland defined white-collar crime as crime committed by a person of respectability and high social status in the course of their occupation. It was a direct challenge to the assumption that crime was a lower-class phenomenon.
Today, after Enron, after the 2008 financial crisis, after Theranos, after FTX, the field seems vindicated. But is white-collar criminology actually well-funded and well-staffed?
It's still the minority of the field. Most criminology departments have one or two people working on corporate crime, while they might have five or six working on street crime. The funding follows the political priorities, and politicians have historically been more interested in fighting street crime than in regulating corporate behavior. That's been shifting somewhat. The financial crisis did focus attention, but the imbalance remains.
Which is itself a criminological finding about the politics of criminology. Who gets studied? Who gets policed? Who gets incarcerated? These are not neutral decisions driven purely by data.
They're not. And that's another thing that might surprise someone entering the field. You go in thinking you're going to study crime objectively, and you quickly realize that the very category of crime is politically constructed. Behaviors get criminalized and decriminalized based on social movements, political power, and historical accident, not just on some neutral assessment of harm. Gambling is legal in some places, criminal in others. Cannabis policy has transformed in the last decade. Adultery is a crime in some jurisdictions and not in others. The criminologist has to study not just the behavior, but the label itself.
The undergraduate Daniel Met is entering a field where the first lesson is that the subject matter is a moving target defined by politics as much as by harm.
That's what makes it intellectually rich. You can't do criminology well without understanding law, sociology, psychology, economics, political science, and history. It's a synthesizing discipline. The best criminologists are intellectual generalists who can integrate insights from multiple fields.
Which circles back to the career question. A field that demands that kind of breadth, where do you actually get hired?
One growing area is data science within criminal justice agencies. Police departments, prosecutors' offices, and corrections departments are increasingly hiring people who can analyze their internal data to identify patterns, evaluate programs, and guide resource allocation. This is sometimes called evidence-based policing or data-driven justice. It's not quite academic criminology, and it's not quite traditional law enforcement. It's a hybrid role that requires both analytic skills and institutional knowledge.
The Comstat model, essentially.
Comstat was the pioneer, yes. It started in the NYPD in the 1990s under Commissioner William Breton and Deputy Commissioner Jack Maple. The idea was to map crime geographically, hold precinct commanders accountable for trends in their areas, and deploy resources based on data rather than tradition. It was controversial. Critics said it created perverse incentives to underreport crime, but it transformed how police departments think about data.
Now every major city has some version of it.
And behind every CompStat meeting is a team of crime analysts, many of whom have criminology backgrounds, preparing the maps and the statistics and the trend lines. They're not making arrests, they're making the arrest strategy possible.
The field has a whole technical infrastructure that's invisible to the public. The analyst in the back room is as much a part of modern policing as the officer on the street.
That analyst might have a master's in criminology and never have worn a uniform in their life. That's the career path Daniel was wondering about. It exists, it's growing, and it's completely separate from the traditional police career ladder.
What about the ethical dimension? Criminologists study people who are often vulnerable. Prisoners, offenders, victims. What are the ethical constraints on the research?
They're substantial. Research involving prisoners has additional federal protections in the United States because prisoners are considered a vulnerable population that cannot freely give consent. Any study involving incarcerated people has to go through extra layers of institutional review board scrutiny. There's a whole history here. The biomedical research abuses of the mid-20th century led to the Belmont Report and the Common Rule, and prisoners were specifically identified as needing special protection.
A criminologist who wants to study prison conditions or rehabilitation programs has to navigate a much more complex ethical approval process than a sociologist studying, say, workplace dynamics.
Much more complex. And for good reason. The power imbalance between a researcher and an incarcerated subject is enormous. The subject might feel that participating or refusing to participate will affect their treatment by prison authorities. They might not understand that the researcher is independent of the prison. The potential for coercion is real.
That's another thing an undergraduate might not anticipate, that a huge part of the job is navigating ethics boards and consent forms.
It's not the glamorous part, but it's essential. Criminology, done right, is a deeply ethical enterprise. You're studying people in some of the worst moments of their lives or under some of the most coercive conditions a state can impose. The methodological rigor and the ethical rigor have to go together.
To pull this together for the person Daniel Met, and for anyone curious about the field, what's the single biggest misconception that needs correcting?
That criminology is about criminals. It's not. It's about the entire system that produces, defines, responds to, and is shaped by crime. The criminal is one small piece of a much larger puzzle. The criminologist studies laws and how they're made. They study police departments as organizations. They study courts and how judges make decisions. They study prisons and what happens inside them. They study communities and why some have more crime than others. They study victims and what they need. They study prevention and what actually works. The criminal, the person who committed the act, is just one node in a vast network of institutions, policies, histories, and social forces.
The criminal is the MacGuffin. The criminologist is studying the whole film.
That's a perfect way to put it. The crime is the event that sets the story in motion, but the story is about everything that happens around it, before, during, and after.
The career paths reflect that breadth. You can end up in a university, a think tank, a government agency, a police department, an insurance company, a cybersecurity firm, a non-profit, or a United Nations agency. The common thread isn't the employer. It's the questions you're trained to ask.
Which is why the academic track makes sense. The questions are sophisticated. They require training in theory, methods, and ethics. You can pick up some of it on the job, but the systematic training of a degree program, especially at the graduate level, is designed to teach you how to ask questions that practitioners often don't have the time or the institutional permission to ask.
The practitioners need those questions asked. A police department that never gets studied from the outside is a department that never improves.
The healthy tension we talked about earlier. It's not comfortable, but it's necessary.
One last thing I want to touch on, the public engagement side. Are criminologists good at communicating what they know to the public, or does the knowledge stay locked in journals?
Historically, not great. The field has a translation problem. There's a huge gap between what criminologists know and what the public believes about crime. Most people get their understanding of crime from news media and entertainment, both of which systematically distort the picture. News media overreports violent crime and underreports the long-term decline in crime rates. Entertainment glorifies detectives and serial killers and SWAT teams. The criminological reality, that crime has been declining for decades, that most crime is property crime, that rehabilitation can work, that longer sentences don't deter, this doesn't make for compelling headlines or exciting television.
The field produces knowledge that could improve policy and public understanding, and then struggles to get anyone to listen.
That's the frustration of a lot of criminologists. They're sitting on evidence that could make the justice system fairer and more effective, and the public conversation is still dominated by anecdotes, fears, and political posturing. Some criminologists have gotten better at public communication. There are podcasts, Substacks, Twitter presences, but the field as a whole hasn't solved the translation problem.
Which is ironic for a field that studies social influence and communication.
It's the cobbler's children problem. We study how messages spread and what changes behavior, but we're not always great at applying it to our own work. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In early medieval Kiribati, it was widely believed that fermented coconut sap could be used to treat skin lesions, based on the theory that the fermentation process transferred the healing properties of the coconut tree's life essence directly into the wound. The practice was abandoned by the 12th century after it was observed that patients treated with the fermented sap developed infections at roughly twice the rate of those left untreated.
They were marinating their wounds in the medieval equivalent of spoiled coconut milk and calling it medicine.
The life essence transfer theory. I'm going to remember that next time I have a cut and someone offers me a bad idea. Thank you to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed the episode, leave us a review. It helps people find the show. We'll be back soon with another one.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.